Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them, and not necessarily those of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters. Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. And good evening, and welcome once again to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I am your host, Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And she is the always lovely. She is the mystical. She is the mysterious. And she is Lynn Nickerson.
Good evening, Willie. How are you doing? Happy Halloween.
And oh, thank you, and happy Halloween to you. I'm doing good.
Good.
Best, it's not officially Halloween yet, but the best day of the year.
You know, it's very close. Best day of the year? Well, you know, there are a couple that rival that, but
I don't know what they would be.
I think it's a great day. Well, your birthday for one, Willie.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't have any more of them. I gave them up. You know that.
Okay. Well, we have a wonderful guest tonight.
We do have a wonderful guest, and you know, it's just coincidence that he was on the show last year on a Halloween show.
That's right.
Not quite sure how that came about, but it was a coincidence.
Providence.
It was a good coincidence, though.
Yes. It was meant to be.
That's what it is. It was meant to be. All right. So, tonight on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, joining us once again for his second appearance on the show is Gary Gillespie. Gary is the author of Chronicles of the Unexplained, true stories of haunted houses, Bigfoot, and other paranormal encounters. The book is filled with fascinating stories from a lifetime of paranormal experiences of the author, as well as stories from a broad range of contributors. It includes Gary's own battle with a not-so-friendly entity. Let's welcome now to Spirit Radio, Gary Gillespie. Good evening, Gary. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. I hope everybody's good out there.
We're doing great. Happy Halloween.
It's good to be back on. It's been exactly a year, hasn't it?
It's weird, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. It's kind of strange. I'm not sure how that happened. But
I wonder if that was planned.
It must have been.
Well, I'm happy it worked out.
Yeah. And we're really happy that you're here again with us.
Yes. Thank you so much for showing up. So
oh,
thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for answering the phone.
You're going to thank me for showing up too.
And you too, Willie.
Okay,
you count.
You. All right.
So Gary, are you working on another book? Have you been gathering stories for another book?
You know, I haven't really been actively searching for stories. They've definitely been coming to me, though. It's
good.
Almost like I really need to get busy and get writing another one. I'm in the middle of another manuscript right now that's largely centered on the history of the trucking industry.
Oh.
And I've got to get that one out of the way because there's just a lot I need to say, and so much of it is that industry is turning to history now, you know. So
yeah,
we've got to catch some of these people while they're still alive and get their stories on paper. But I'm really kind of just, well, almost getting bombarded with stories from people from all over the country. But So I know I'm going to have to do something else. I know I'm going to have to get moving on this, but I'm really drawn back to Central City, Colorado. I would love to just do a book on Central City, Colorado. That would be my my big goal. I will get that done.
Well, to do that, do you think you'd have to move up to that area again?
Yeah. We're not completely away either. We have a place down in southern Colorado, so we can kind of bounce back and forth. But you know, it is kind of, you know, when you work away from Colorado and stuff like that, it is tough. You need to be there. You have to kind of be there for a little while.
Yeah.
You know, and feel the vibe and get back into that, you know, frame of mind again to really get things moving.
That Colorado frame of mind.
Yeah.
That's it.
So is your place down around Eads?
It's actually around Walsenburg, between Walsenburg and Levita. So we're quite a bit up higher than Eads.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. So people are sending you paranormal stories or just the trucking industry?
Well, paranormal stories, yeah.
Oh, good.
You know, I do a little book signing here and there, and then just at work even, and people that I run into, you know, casual talk, and you know, it's just kind of funny how I really don't bring it up, but sometimes those conversations just kind of go that direction.
Mm.
And that's what happened to me in the oil field, you know. It's like I went up there to work and make money. I didn't go up there to write a ghost book, but that's what happened.
Yeah, that's wonderful that people have been opening up to you. Are there going to be paranormal stories in the history of the trucking industry? I mean, are they kind of like inextricably linked, like ghost stories of Route 66?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, some of the stories that I have down from what truckers have experienced, especially back in the 70s and the 80s and oh yeah, there's definitely going to be a section of weird paranormal type stories in that. But there has to be. I mean, it seems like that industry just goes hand in hand.
Exactly.
Railroad, trucking, you know, pipeline welders. Basically, everything I've done in my entire life, you know, where you're out and all by yourself in the middle of nowhere, it just brings those stories out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there will definitely be a section for it.
Oh,
you
good.
You own your own company now, do you? Is that right?
Yes,
trucking?
I do.
Yeah.
I work for a company, and then I also have my own welding business on the side, yes. So we've got welding trucks, you know, running around and stuff like that. Just anything to stay busy. You know,
sure.
Right now the oil industry is not good, so the opportunities, you know, are pretty slim to do anything, you know, like in North Dakota or northeastern Colorado right now. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, I spent over 30 years driving myself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're chronicling the trucking industry. That's great. I think that stuff has to be preserved, the information.
Yes, it does. It's amazing. My wife had actually pointed that out, you know, is that the trucking industry that you grew up in, that
different.
My mother actually started that business in 1979, and what it is now, it's just an echo of what it used to be. You know, what I see out there, and I don't want this to sound wrong, but it just seems to be a kind of more of a bunch of trained puppies out there now, where back in the 70s and 80s, and the guys I grew up with, it was a different world. I'm sure
you're
you can
right.
vouch for that, Willie.
It was, definitely.
You were needed to move fast. One statement that was made is that people won't buy green meat and brown lettuce. You know, you've got to go.
That's right. That's right. Well, why weren't you there yesterday?
Yeah. Well, Gary, then how about you had sent me a photo of your son, and I know that we kind of talked at length about your house in the Redlands, but would you like to touch on the photo about your son and what happened during that period of time?
Yeah, it was pretty much the height of the problems we were having in that house. Everything seemed to be accelerating. I had left Grand Junction, Colorado, not permanently. We still had the home in Grand Junction, Colorado, and went to North Dakota to work in the oil fields. That would have been in February when I left. My wife went up there with me for our first hitch, and in March we received three photographs that my mother had taken on a cell phone of my son and his girlfriend on prom night. And there were three photographs. One came out really good. No interference in the picture whatsoever. It was just a perfectly clear picture of my son and his girlfriend. The next two had two very visible entities in them. When I first saw it, I mean, it was so clear on the telephone when she had sent us those pictures, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, it was at that point we realized it was time to get out of that house. It was you know, in the picture, it was almost like they were, I wouldn't say heckling us, but, you know, basically it was almost like a point, you're not going to get rid of us, you know. One was leaning on my son's right shoulder, and the other entity that showed up in the picture was next to his girlfriend, kind of off of her shoulder, but had a real distorted face. It was very unnerving.
Mm. So what eventually became of that house? You did sell it, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's not held an owner very long since then.
Ooh.
It's as a matter of fact, the house, I believe, is up for sale again. I just kind of was glancing through Zillow here the other day, and it's back on the market again.
Wow.
So I guess that would be two owners since 2012.
Wow. Did you have to disclose? Does Colorado have the law about disclosing about ghosts when you come to sell?
No, no. I would imagine if there had been a murder or something in the house, that would have been different. But it certainly wasn't disclosed to us when we bought it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Some states do have the disclosure law that you have to, and other states don't.
You bet.
Well, I'm glad you're out of that and away from it now.
I bet you're glad you're out of it too.
Yeah, we are. It, you know, it took a while. Things kind of faded away. We had to come back to Iowa for our house here, but I had moved to Bailey and then back up to St. Mary's Glacier in that time period from 2011 to 13 is what it was. And, you know, the first move to Bailey, we still had some activity. The move to St. Mary's Glacier, it was just about all gone. And I think we're all clean and clear now. But, you know, we decided in Bailey to get rid of everything, all the furniture and everything that was in that house.
That's a good idea.
It felt like we were bringing something with us.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Attachments. You just never know.
No, you don't.
Well, I wanted to get into, particularly starting with a most disturbing curse. I wanted to touch on that, but I'd like to highlight the idea of residual energy and place memory, just to give this a little bit of a preview and put it in context.
Yes.
And place memory is generally, just for our audience, when acts or events are seemingly imprinted on the atmosphere, in the atmosphere, or in the surroundings, like either the physical location, the ground, like a house or the wood or even objects, as we were just saying. So none of us really know what the paranormal is, other than it's considered a normal condition in the extreme, hence the word supernatural. So just this week, we were talking to a friend of ours on our first TV taping. His name is Paul Eno, and he believes in the theory of quantum physics.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the theory to explain seemingly multiple universes that exist side by side. And the explanation breaks down into the paranormal being reduced to subatomic particles, which seem to know no restriction on timelines or dimensions. So I've been giving this a lot of thought, and like I said, we don't know what ghosts are. We don't know what these replayed events are. So I'm beginning to think that maybe our present timeline is the fourth dimension, and that maybe ghostly events are taking place in the fifth dimension. So the fifth dimension could be a combination of all five dimensions. R3 and time is 4, but yet that fifth dimension is maybe another timeline. So
That's
kind of the conclusion I'm coming down to, that maybe these subatomic particles vibrate at a certain frequency, and maybe, too, they vibrate within patterns. So maybe this a reenactment of something that you might come across that is like a paranormal event might be a pattern that is locked, like in the fourth dimension. And it just depends on people being able to perceive this, or when conditions are right so that you can perceive it. So I think that maybe this stuff might always be there. It just has to be perceived under the right conditions, or it has to be the right person that is able to perceive it.
Sure.
So jumping into Colorado, the Eads area, I wanted to talk about the Sand Creek Massacre and the history on that and what you experienced there.
Well, it definitely fits the category.
It
does,
doesn't it?
That's an awful lot to think about, by the way.
I've been giving it a lot of thought.
But I think that was an excellent lead up to this story. I think the ground is I call it cursed, but in the title of the story. But there's definitely something wrong there. I mean, you
well, so much bad has happened.
I think everybody, maybe most everybody that's listening to this program tonight, has been somewhere they don't feel right at.
Sure.
You know, and I have places that I've traveled throughout my life, you know, and certain areas I just can't wait to get out of. It's not explainable.
That's right.
I'm not comfortable there. Sand Creek is definitely, you know, the Sand Creek Battleground is definitely one of those areas.
There's
probably, in my opinion, one of the most misinterpreted, incorrectly represented historical stories in the state of Colorado. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
The winners always write the history, don't they, Gary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they do. In this case, I would happen to say that maybe it's the other way. Leading up to this battle, most people don't know. What people, I think, seem to know about the Sand Creek Massacre is that Native American women and children were killed,
mm-hmm.
mutilated, raped. We can go on and on and on about
mm-hmm.
it. But what they don't know are the events that lead it up to it. You know, of course, we know about the Bad Treaties back in the 1850s. But 1864, the year of the Sand Creek Massacre, was an unbelievable year for Colorado. They were really crying out for somebody like Mr. Shivington. Governor Evans needed help, was begging for help from the U.S. government, but of course they couldn't give him any, because of the Civil War. The Civil War was in full swing by that time.
Right.
There was evidence, historical evidence, that the Confederacy had actually supplied arms to the Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Kiowa to keep things stirred up.
Really?
You know, to try to create a Western Front, if you will.
Really?
And but by the time the Sand Creek Massacre had occurred, Denver was completely under siege and starving. And this is a part of the story that nobody ever talks about. Both the Platte River roads and the Smoky Hill routes were completely shut down. The Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Kiowa were doing a great job of cutting off supply routes to Denver. And then the massacres started. And by that, by the time of the Sand Creek Massacre, there were well over 250 white settlers that had been killed and mutilated.
Mm.
The most popular of which was the Hungate family. They were found, their bodies were found, and it was a husband, a wife, and two children. And they were horribly massacred. They were loaded onto a wagon. Their bodies were found by freighters, and they were carted into Denver and put on public display.
Mm.
So that can kind of put into, you know, the mindset of why what happened. I'm not making excuses for it, but I can place the anger.
Well, what was going on with the Arapaho and the Cheyenne and the Kiowa? Why were they going through a period of unrest at that point?
Well, without a doubt, they'd been lied to.
Okay,
I
because
mean,
of the treaties,
no other
you mean?
Way to put it. You know, if you look at press reports from that time or ads, you know, I shouldn't say ads, but promotions trying to get white settlers into the state of Colorado and throughout the West, you know, you'll see these writings of vast amounts of land, you know, to homestead, you know, free to the first man that finds it, and trying to create towns along the right of way of the railroads but it was totally misrepresented. That
mm-hmm.
land had already been given to them in treaty. That wasn't, you know, a white settler's land. That was the Arapaho, Kiowa, Cheyenne, Sioux. They knew what their land was, but apparently we didn't.
Okay.
No sooner than when those treaties were signed, we had forgotten them.
Okay.
You know, they weren't any worth any more than the paper they were signed on, obviously.
So then the Hungate family was put on display, and then what happened?
Well, after that, of course, there was incredible anger. The city of Denver had to do something. I mean, they needed their supplies. People were starving. They could neither ship out or receive freight in. And so Shivington appeared to be the answer. And, of course, I'm condensing this. This is a very complicated story.
Mm-hmm.
They had been warned, the Indians had, that they needed to stand down. Lay down their arms, and there were fort sites or campsites throughout the state of Colorado, and three I can think of right off the top of my head where the peaceful Indians were supposed to go. They were supposed to go there and camp, and that way the Third Colorado Volunteers, the military representation of the territory at that time, would know where these peaceful Indians are and after a specific date, then any Indians found outside of these areas were to be killed. There's no other way to put it. There was no quarter. There were orders of no quarter from Governor Evans. And so the massacre at Sand Creek, which was Chief Black Kettle's people, they believed there were dog soldiers with them. Roman Nose, I believe, was there. There were also some white traders there that were camped with them. They were outside of what was considered that safe zone, and they believed that it was a hostile encampment at the time of the move on the camp.
So was this Cherokee and Nez Perce people?
I'm sorry?
Was it the Cherokee and the Nez Perce people?
No. You mean of the people that were killed in this massacre?
Yeah.
No, it was largely Cheyenne and Arapaho.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they were they were the peaceful tribes then at this point, weren't they?
They were believed to be peaceful in later historical accounts. But that is I think where there is a misrepresentation on this particular massacre. In my studies, I find that they weren't peaceful. They were well armed and they were ready for the attack.
Okay.
That still doesn't justify what happened after the battle. The battle, incidentally, it began as an accident. Chivington was moving on them. He didn't know where they were. The November 29th was the day he was going to attack. They had moved close to the encampment before sunrise. And believe it or not, the surprise attack was ruined. But they discovered through an accident that the Indian encampment had already known that Chivington was there, and they were already entrenched and ready for a battle. But a private named George Pierce, his horse became skittish just right about sunrise and bolted with him on it right into the Indian encampment. He kept pulling back on the reins to get the horse to stop. The horse laid over on its side. He stood up, turned to run back towards Chivington's line, and was shot dead. So that literally the first fatality of that battle was a Third Colorado volunteer.
Then what followed?
What followed was 7 hours of battle. History doesn't really report exactly what I believe happened. I mean, if a person would research it a little bit, they fought, and they fought hard, meaning the Cheyenne and the Arapaho. And I think if I were of their people or from their tribe, I would like to be remembered that way myself. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to be remembered as a weak one getting ground into the sand. And there is definitely evidence that they fought and fought hard. Men, women, children. Children and women loading, firearms for the Braves. But when the Third Colorado Volunteers did gain control of the site, when they began to overtake them, that's when things became in question. And the atrocities were hideous. I don't even think we could probably repeat them on the air.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a way I could clean it up a little bit. But there was rape. There was the murder of children. There was mutilation, and basically I think the Third Colorado Volunteers went completely out of control during that battle and just basically had their way with the people.
And this was down in the southeastern section of Colorado, sort of a little bit northeast of Eads then, right?
Yes, actually, ironically now, it's east-northeast of Eads, and it's probably closest to the town of Brandon or, ironically, Chivington, Colorado. It'd be straight north of Chivington.
Yes, I saw that on the map.
Plains. I think the biggest towns, Kit Carson, Cheyenne Wells, Lamar, kind of in a triangle, right in the middle.
So, hearkening back to what we were talking about, residual energy, what are some of the testimonies, Gary, of people who have driven through the area or visited, even tourists?
Well, the most popular one, the one that hit me the hardest, was Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell from the state of Colorado, who was also, I believe he was Cheyenne. He's a full-blooded Cheyenne. And he had stated in a newspaper article back in the 1990s that he had visited the site several times and had heard what he thought were women and children crying. And that one kind of put a lump in my throat. I really very much liked Ben Nighthorse Campbell. I thought he was a great representation of the state of Colorado. But that's just one of hundreds of stories of people that visit the place and feel overwhelming grief, begin to cry for really no reason, stand there for 2 minutes, turn around, get in their car, and leave. There's no time for it. They want to get out of there.
One of the reports...
Sorry?
I was just going to say, one of the reports is of seeing a large Indian encampment at the site, which is somewhat shrouded by fog or mist on a wet, cold November evening. Ranchers on horseback have seen this.
Yes. Oh, yes. The first account of that was almost exactly 1 year after the battle.
Oh.
And they were actually buffalo hunters that were out there that had seen them. It had been reported to the military representation in the area, and they did send scouts out to find them. They wanted to know what was going on there. Of course, they found nothing.
Because they thought it was that real.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder, what exactly is imprinted? Is it an imprint? If so, what is it imprinting on? Or does it boil down to the subatomic particle theory where things happen in sort of like little patterns? And when it's charged, maybe some people are just sensitive enough to pick up on it?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I think that's a good explanation. I mean, I'm much more simplistic, but to have an area that is just so tainted with grief, so much blood spilled on that ground, how can there not be an imprint there?
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a conscience, if you have a soul, you have to feel it.
Also, too, it says several members of the Cheyenne tribe have recalled hearing sounds of death wails and children crying in the early morning hours in November.
Correct.
Have you driven through that area? Have you been to the site?
Oh, countless times, yes.
So do you still feel the trauma?
Yeah. I don't particularly like being there.
Yeah.
I love the eastern plains of Colorado. I call that the real Colorado, especially now. Don't get me wrong, the mountains are incredible. People think I'm crazy for thinking that way, but I love the history. I love the land. I love everything about it. But that area is really disturbing to me.
Yeah, it's just imbued with tragedy.
Yes.
Well, how about the story about the Pony Express? There was a trucker that had an experience with the Pony Express.
Yeah. This is a neat place because you can actually, I mean, you can really pin it on a map. You can drive there tomorrow if you're close enough. But for the Brady rest area, the westbound Interstate 80 rest area, and it's a town called Brady.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very nice rest area there, large mature trees there. It pulls you way off of the highway where a lot of the rest areas in Nebraska used to be just a few feet off of the interstate. This one is really nice. It pulls you back into the trees, and it's a really nice, comfortable place to stop. And the story as told to me was this driver was out walking his dog at about 2 a.m. and heard a horse galloping from the east and cut right through the stand of trees that he was walking in. He pulled his dog back to him and watched the horse blow by him with a rider on his back into the parking lot and disappear behind a camper. And I'd also heard of a sighting out towards Ogallala, North Platte, on the in between those two towns, once again paralleling Interstate 80 on the north side of the interstate. Seeing a horse and rider out there that appeared to be a Pony Express rider.
That must have freaked him out.
Go. You know, they disappear as fast as people see them. I think the most active areas are probably the Gothenburg, Nebraska area. There is still an old Pony Express station there that is used like a little museum.
No kidding.
And, of course, that Brady rest area that I had mentioned.
And wasn't the Pony Express only lasted for about a year, right? From 1861 to 62.
It was a very short-lived endeavor, but boy, did it make some heroes. Yeah, it was from April of 1860 to October of 1861, and the routes began in St. Joseph, Missouri, and basically followed what is now the Transcontinental Railroad System, the Union Pacific Railroad System, all the way to the coast. So it completed a communications gap that we had in the West at that time until a transcontinental telegraph could be put into place.
So did this writer appear?
Funny for something that was so short-lived.
Yeah.
How popular it is in American lore. Yeah.
Truly, it is. Did this trucker actually feel that this was an individual, a real human person, or could he see through it? Do you know?
Oh no. Yeah. It was definitely a paranormal contact. Yes. It was. it was as if it were illuminated. You know, but he knew it wasn't. You know, from our dimension.
Yeah,
that way.
It's really weird to get sensory evidence like that. It just really plays on your mind. That was a really interesting tale. Well, go ahead, Billy.
I was just going to say it's the bottom of the hour.
It is so. The bottom of the hour, and we're going to have to take a quick break, Gary.
Okay,
so
sounds
soon.
Good.
So we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Don't go away.
Supernatural Magazine, the UK's newest paranormal magazine, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. You are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience on WSCA 106.1 FM, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Our upcoming guest list. That starts with November the 5th, next Saturday, and we are taking that off. Beginning with Saturday, November 12th, we're welcoming Artie Clark, and she's the author of More Encounters with Star People, and she's talked to a lot of Native people, Native Americans in particular, and Central Native Americans, about their contact with star people. Fascinating book. The 19th, Joni Mahon, and she's got a new book out called Ghost Magnet, so we'll be discussing that. And the 26th, we're welcoming back Ken Gerhart, and he has out a new book entitled Mysterious Menagerie of Beasts. And let me see, one more day. Well, December 3rd is unbooked right now, but Varla Ventura will be joining us on the 10th to discuss gnomes and fairies and strange little creatures. So that wraps up our guest list.
That is our guest list. So let's go back to the phone right
Get
now.
Back to Gary.
Well, tonight's guest, Gary Gillespie. welcome back, Gary.
Welcome back, Gary.
Yes.
Well, I wanted to get into your chapter, Disport into the Past. You touched on three interesting occurrences, one regarding the Gilpin Tram, the other one, the haunted schoolhouse, and then things that happened up at St. Mary's Glacier. So would you like to start with the Gilpin Tram?
Yes. My favorite, yes.
Yeah.
A little 2-foot gauge railroad that was built out of Black Hawk, Colorado, to serve the mines in the area. And you guys had a lot of 2-foot gauge railroads out in your part of the country, too. So the railroad was, especially when my wife and I were back in our 20s, was very easy to follow with a Jeep. And we ran several miles of the railroad grade to this little railroad and studied it up and down. And in those days, it was a lost railroad. There are people now that have researched it and written excellent books on it. But in those days, you really had to dig for history on that one.
Was that for passengers or was that for hauling ore?
It was mainly for hauling ore, but they did have some makeshift passenger cars that they would take people for Sunday afternoon picnics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, they did enjoy themselves a little too up there.
Yeah. As much as you can in the middle of the woods.
That's right. It was a very lively little railroad. There was one engine, engine number 3. I don't know what it is about the number 3 and locomotives, but it seems like a pretty popular number for an engine that keeps wrecking over and over and over again.
Really?
And it was definitely one of them. It had actually killed an engineer and a fireman. And people like to, at least when they write about the railroads and stuff like that and the old steamers, the engine killed him. It had nothing to do with the rail rolling over on him or a bridge collapsing. The engine did it.
It's,
you know,
the engine.
And so for some reason, if we were to pick one out of the roster of 5 locomotives that little railroad owned, it would probably have to be number 3 that's still poking around the hills of Gilpin and far eastern Clear Creek County up there. Whistles have been heard. I've heard countless stories of people seeing lights, especially on Quartz Hill, which was one of the busiest areas for the Gilpin tram. And
is there anything else running around, Gary, that it could be? Are there any
other
trains that could possibly be what they're seeing? Or are there
no? I don't know. They like to think that it's the ghost of the train. Yep.
Well, that's what I would like to
think. People describe it anyway, you know, the dim lights.
Are there tracks?
On the old railroad grade and the sound of the whistle.
Yeah, are there still any tracks left at all?
None.
No?
No.
There you go.
Yep, it's completely gone. The grade is there.
You can
stand in several places, different vantage points in that county, and see exactly where it ran. There's absolutely no question whatsoever as to its route. It can be walked. It can be hiked. In places it can be jeeped. There's still some bridges that are left there. A lot of them, they built like these interesting rock wall bridges that also served as little dams to control runoff. Some of those structures are still there, but no track, no rolling stock. There's literally nothing left of it. As a matter of fact, the only known piece that is left of anything of the Gilpin tram outside of a few spikes is a piece of the smokestack to engine number 3, and it's sitting at the Colorado Railroad Museum.
Huh. I'll be darned. So that, do they see the lights or hear the whistle on any kind of a basis? Is there a pattern to it?
No, doesn't seem to be. Mm-mm. No, it's just kind of a come-and-go event.
Okay, so what else?
There's gotta be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah,
that's right.
Got to be able to perceive it. What about the old schoolhouse in Alice, Colorado?
Yes, that was a little more personal for us. We had moved to Alice in 1993. When we moved there, you had to have a four-wheel drive or you weren't getting home. I mean, it was just way up there. Our house sat at 9,900 feet.
Oh, my.
We weren't the highest house in the area by no means. But those first few years that we were there, I think we might have been one of maybe 15 or 20 homes that were permanent residence. The rest of them would close down. And we had heard some cute little stories about the schoolhouse. I had seen the schoolhouse years before when we would go jeeping through the area, you know, and kind of check the area out and stuff like that. But it became more personal when we moved there. One of the first stories that I'd heard, which of course I didn't put in the book, was about they would rent it out or open it up on Saturday nights and stuff for the local residents to maybe go and play pool or have a chili cook-off or something like that there, you know, and just odds and ends events that would happen up there just for the locals. And one of our neighbors was playing pool down there one night and was with a friend of his and his girlfriend. And so they were kind of going back and forth playing pool, and all of a sudden she started screaming. And, of course, she had a cigarette, and she had laid it in an ashtray so she could take her shot. And when she got back to the cigarette, there was lipstick on it. Well, of course, she wasn't wearing lipstick, and it really bothered her. And that was probably the first story I'd heard about it. And then, of course, later on, 1993 to 1996, we had heard about people actually hearing children playing inside the schoolhouse, which was kind of interesting. And the story that I put in the book was really kind of a cute story, I thought, about a child that had seen other children there playing and wanted to go play with them.
Yeah, he wanted to go play on the good swings inside.
On the swings
inside
the building.
Yes, they got so much snow up there. I mean, even in dry years up there, we would get at least 200 inches of snow.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, stronger years, you could be up bumping 300 inches of snow up there. So when the children back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, would get their recess or take a break at school, they many times they had to play inside. It was just too deep and too cold to play outside. Mm-hmm. And so they installed swings and stuff like that inside the schoolhouse that, of course, could be slid over to the side or disassembled so they could have their regular classes. And then when break would come, they could hang the swings from the ceiling again and have a little fun inside.
Well, the story was that the little boy saw it, and his mother didn't believe him until she spoke to a woman that was inside cleaning or something.
Yeah.
And she went on to explain that there were swings there.
There were, and many people that even local residents there that were unaware of that. There was a steel
like a strap
that was installed, and it was hung across the ceiling of the interior of the school. So basically, it kind of flanked the north side of the actual school room, mm-hmm. and then behind it now is a kitchen that the residents use, you know, for family events and stuff like that. And it's just right there. And it spans the whole width of that room, and swings were actually hung from that pipe. And most people had no idea what that was even for.
Yeah.
You know? And this story sure brought it out, is that, you know, the playground equipment that was outside of the schoolhouse back in the 90s wasn't maintained. It was old. I mean, some of it was 95 years old.
Wow.
And they were, you know, just kind of broken down and in disrepair, and this little child saw kids inside playing on the better swings and told his mother about it. Well, you know, of course, they knew nothing about the interior swings until she had spoken to the gal that was cleaning the place.
Oh, that's a neat little story.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's a cool story. And, of course, that gal has long since passed away, and, you know, another person has taken over the duties of kind of taking care of the building there. But they, she had some really interesting stories back in the early 90s. It was really interesting.
Well, what is it about St. Mary's Glacier that hikers and campers report strange stories?
Yes. Yeah. It's a dangerous place.
Is it?
Right off bat. It was believed to be kind of a sacred place for the Ute Indians. Of course, there was a lot of fresh water there. There is a known to be Ute Indian burial ground up there.
Oh.
The husband of the man, or of the woman that I had just told you about that was cleaning the schoolhouse, you know, she maintained the schoolhouse. Well, he claims to know exactly where the burial ground is, but will refuse to tell anybody.
Yeah, I can't believe
where it's at. He especially would not tell me because I told him I was putting a manuscript together a few years ago, and he says it's just best that nobody knows, you know, where it is. But there is believed to be a curse on that valley. The Ute Indians were basically run out of the valley for gold prospectors, and the belief is that there was a curse put on the valley that no white man would ever succeed there. And if one would use, what was produced there in the mines, yeah, they're probably right. It was kind of on a borderline of gold and silver, Georgetown, Colorado being really strong in silver, and Gilpin County, Colorado, where the little tram ran, was really strong in gold, and for some reason St. Mary's Glacier really didn't have a lot of either.
Oh. So what about the highwayman that was reported? Or was that Pike's Peak, actually?
There were a lot of things reported up there. Forest Road 175, which basically runs between... I might be confusing people, because St. Mary's Glacier and Alice are pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The town was originally called Alice, Colorado. Of course, it's not incorporated now. The area is called St. Mary's Glacier, and it attracts a lot of recreational-type people there every year. But Forest Road 175 was originally a carriage route, if you will, a wagon road,
mm-hmm.
that came from Golden, Colorado to Blackhawk before the Colorado Central actually came up the canyon, Clear Creek Canyon. Then from Blackhawk to Central City, Central City to Alice, and then back over, you know, farther west over to Georgetown and Silver Plume. So it was a very busy road.
Okay.
And campers have told me of stories of hearing wagons running across that road in the middle of the night.
Oh.
It's a very heavily traveled jeep road now because of its close proximity to the Denver area. It's a really nice day trip for people, which now with the jeep craze makes it very busy. Back when my wife and I were really hitting it hard there in jeeps, you know, you may see one other vehicle in an entire day up in that area, but that's definitely changed now. So it seems like more exposure has brought more stories out.
Okay.
You know, when I was much younger, You know, we'd heard stories about that area. We've heard of areas that we shouldn't go in, you know, because of the notorious reputation of certain areas up there. And so, but it was really interesting to start hearing this from people, you know, what they've experienced up there. Hearing stamp mill run, for example, which is a sound that, that many people haven't heard in over a century.
Yeah, they heard the stamp mill
really incredible
hammering, and
yeah.
the and the wagons.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And something about a highwayman who was murdered more than 100 years ago when they sort of sense him in the area.
Yes, that one is more towards Fountain, Colorado. That would be down towards the Colorado Springs area.
Oh, Little Fountain Creek, okay.
Yes, yes. And he, yeah, that dates back to a murder. Now, I'm the names are slipping me right now as to who the victim was and who the accused murderer was. Now, my publisher didn't want those names printed for fear that family members might, not want that in print.
Mm-hmm.
So we did hold those out of the book. But, yeah, that's right now a hiking trail in the area of Pikes Peak seems to be the focal point for this.
Good place to stay away from.
And people see him, and it appears that he's not happy that they are there. He comes across as a dark form. People kind of get a foreboding feeling, and you know, like we talked about earlier, about that feeling of not being comfortable where you're at,
right.
You just want to leave.
It's
more of a feeling than a physical being.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Gary, what about your chapter "To Die or Not to Die," about the woman in Nevadaville?
Yes.
In the cemetery.
Yes. This takes us back to Central City and Black Hawk again.
Yeah.
And I don't know why people are attracted to the area for that reason, but there has been more than I think their fair share of suicides in the area, and many of those people are not from that area. You know, they seem to come there to end their life for whatever reason. As stated in the book, I can't imagine getting to that dark of a place. I mean, but just imagine being that far out, not feeling like you have any friends, not having anybody to rely on, and now this is your choice. And one woman had gone to Central City to just do that, to just end her life. She'd had enough. And what had happened was is that she said it was as if her own mother or grandmother were speaking to her. She had no idea where the voice was coming from, but she was up above Central City, Colorado, in the area of the cemeteries, and she started to cry. It was like whatever this voice was calmly talking her down and telling her that you have a purpose here, you need to live. And it worked for her. She works in the Central City area now, and her life is completely turned around.
So, that's amazing.
Very, very good story there.
Wasn't that cemetery located in Nevadaville, though, just outside of Central City?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
And they all kind of come together up at the top of the hill there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very fine line.
It's a very desolate area, though, or it used to be.
Oh, yes, yes. Like I say, just in the last decade or so has the popularity really gone up in that area. You know, like I told you, the Jeep craze has really brought people.
Yeah.
You know, into those more remote areas. But you're right, Lynn. You know, this time of year, 25 years ago, you would be lucky to see more than five, you know, if you saw five people.
Yeah, truly, the roads were in terrible shape at that point.
Yes.
There wasn't much
in the way
of roads. Well, then that leads me to, I really wanted to talk about your chapter, A Ghost Town Dies. You almost should have titled that The Avenging Ghosts because of what the gambling industry did to Black Hawk and Central City.
Yes.
I haven't been back there since then, but in reading your book again, it's just astounding how big money moves into a town and changes the face of these towns, particularly Black Hawk and Central City.
Yes.
So would you like to say what they did and
what
resulted?
Yeah. Yeah, that would take more than an hour to cover it all. But
you can summarize it.
Believe it or not, Lynn, there's a skyscraper there now. You
I
know
find
that
hard to believe.
Yeah. So basically, remembering what Black Hawk was, Black Hawk to me was a museum.
Oh, it was great.
It was very run down.
All the old houses.
Oh, yes.
Banks.
Yes,
and
yes, all the old Victorian houses.
Yeah.
And you know, what was left of the town buildings. I loved it for that.
Me too.
To me, that was perfect. I didn't want to see it change, but that's that's selfish Gary there. I didn't think that it was right. As a matter of fact, my wife and I boycotted it. We live just over the hill from it at St. Mary's Glacier or Alice, and I refused to go there for well over 4 years. I was so angry about the passage of gambling in those two towns.
Why don't they?
Always the lesser of the two. Central City was a big, beautiful mountain city, and you've seen it years ago, and just imagine it in its grandeur. And there was always a joke about the fecal matter always flowed downhill from Central City to Black Hawk. Well, they've definitely turned that around now and figured out how to pump it back up the hill again. So but the stories that I heard because it wasn't approved until 1993. That's when construction was supposed to start. But in 1992, before it ever touched the ballot, people were already purchasing these buildings, making offers to local residents that had been there for generations, some of which they'd better not refuse, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the properties were condemned so they could acquire the land. Keep in mind, the whole area was a Superfund site. And, so if you or I owned 5 acres in the Black Hawk area and tried to sell it, we couldn't because of the environmental ramifications that would go with it. Property would have to be cleaned before it could change title, basically. You could never afford to do that.
And also, weren't they the historic preservation sites, some of them?
Yes, they were. They were both on the National Historic Registry. And Black Hawk, I'm not positive, can still hold that title. I've heard they still do. Central City, of course, is much more in the original condition than Black Hawk is.
Oh, that's a shame.
But I was friends with a police officer. I actually worked with him when we were, because Clear Creek County and Gilpin County government, I was involved with quite a bit there from emergency services perspective. We had fought fires there and, ambulance and stuff like that. And so I knew these guys real well. But he had told me what was happening in the town of Black Hawk during the destruction of the town. Basically, they just hollowed out what buildings they wanted to keep, took all of the floors out of them, auctioned the furniture off, some of this all original, and went all to, different corners of the world. And then as the places were starting to go back together, he was greeted all night long as a police officer in the area to constant alarms, constant doors open, windows open, lights on in buildings with no electricity, and reports of breaking and entering. And, of course, when they searched the buildings, and it happened on more than one occasion, but, of course, I accounted probably my favorite story, which was the old Gilpin Hotel, which I think you may have seen in the book, where they actually searched the whole building, Bruce and two Gilpin County Sheriff's deputies, and found nothing until they locked the building up and he was ready to leave and looked up in the window and there was a woman in Victorian dress staring down at him as he was driving off.
And that wasn't the only story of these avenging ghosts. I mean, this property was pretty much taken out of the hands of the owners, told that it was condemned. This big company assumed these buildings, but they did nothing to reverse the condemnation of the buildings. They did nothing to, build them back up again, to restore them. They just took them.
Yes. There were several that were moved. I think although this house is now preserved in perfect condition, it's called the Lace House that was in Black Hawk, Colorado.
Oh,
you can
remember
Google
that.
It and you'll get all kinds of pictures of it. But the house was facing North Clear Creek. It was down right in to the south of the main part of the town of Black Hawk, and that's where the house was built. It was an absolutely beautiful representation of Victorian architecture, and that house was literally blasted around. It was on a mountain, but by the time they were done, just for a parking lot in Black Hawk, they had completely blasted out the entire mountain around it. Maybe 500 yards behind it was a vertical wall that had had shotcrete put on it that might be 150 feet high, and there she sits on a pile of dirt. It was the only vehicle or building that wasn't destroyed in that area or flat out moved until they found a place for it. And the city of Black Hawk did move the house up the hill and made sort of a mini museum for some of the Victorian homes there. So it is preserved. It is in beautiful condition. And gambling money did do that, I have to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, there were some good things that came from this. But it was very sad to see that happen.
Oh, yeah. So not only the people lost their homes, but I think the ghosts were very upset at being pushed out.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, knowing that area and what I've learned of that area from especially from Leanna Jonas, who's the proprietor of the Spirit Realm Investigative Project, one of the ghost hunters that my wife had got me in contact with, where she explained just how active Black Hawk and Central City are. It completed the circle for me from the reports that I had heard from firefighters and police officers in that area during the construction of the gambling, properties and stuff like that, and what was going on. She made sense of it for me, you know, as to why things were the way they were. And I thought I was going to tell her story she hadn't heard, and boy, she just added 100 to them.
Wow. Well, you know, we're almost at the end of the hour, Gary. Really,
yeah, we got about 2 minutes left. Oh,
okay, you mentioned my final ride through a Central City cemetery.
Yes.
And would you like to give us your reflections on that?
Yeah. It was, believe it or not, I really fought hard to even get that story in the book.
Really?
But for me, it was a very moving experience. I knew I had to come back to Iowa. I didn't want to. I love that area. I feel as if I'd been there before, mm-hmm. you know, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to take one more ride on my dirt bike and over from Alice, Colorado, over to the top of Central City. And, you know, the feelings that came through, I rode there late in the evening. I got over to Central City just as the sun was setting. And it just became an overwhelming, overpowering feeling that those people are still there. And if there's one message... And it seems to me like somebody or something is really pushing to get a message out. I feel it's don't forget us.
Yeah,
and I strongly believe that's what it is. Those that have passed before us live forever if we don't forget them.
That's right.
And I think that's a very important duty for anybody that puts pen to paper. Be accurate about it. Remember those people and represent them how they would have wanted to be represented.
Yeah, I think it was a good idea that you kept it in the book. I think that's excellent.
I do too.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, it's a crowning glory there. Wonderful stories, Gary. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, Gary. We unfortunately are out of time. But we do have enough time, though, if you want to tell people where to buy the book.
It can be found just about anywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You can pretty much just Google Chronicles of the Unexplained and it'll come up. My website is a very long address, all one word, Gary Gillespie, chroniclesoftheunexplained.com. You can find that. Okay. Of course, I'm on Facebook too under Gary Gillespie, so I can be found.
And there are many more stories in there that we didn't cover, so...
Yes, tons. Yes.
Not only that, but there's a new book going to be coming out.
That's right.
That's right.
You better believe it, yes.
Well,
and Willie, I'll be talking to you about some trucking stories. How about that?
Oh, okay. All right.
Very
okay.
good. Thank you, Gary, and happy Halloween again.
Happy Halloween. Yeah. It's a great time. I really love you guys. Thanks for having me back on. Yeah.
Thank you so
happy
much,
Happy Halloween,
too.
Gary. Thank you very much.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Have a good
Bye.
Night. Okay, well, you know what? That is another episode of Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. And Craig Mosier with The Graveyard Shift is coming right up.
Oh, it's such a sad end to a great night. Just hate to have it end. But happy Halloween, everyone, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, happy Halloween.
In this one of many possible worlds, all for the best, or some bizarre test. It is what it is, and whatever. Time is still the infinite jest. The arrow flies when you dream. The hours tick away, the cells take away. The watchmaker keeps to his schemes. The hours tick away, they tick away. The measure of a life is a measure. So easily.